He was looking at her closely, and his expression was so honestly perplexed that she felt a wave of her own despair. "It's feelings I'm talking about, not facts."
"Yes, but why?"
"I'm telling you why. I'm telling you that I got so I was spending enough time in front of the mirror to see how my face was changing, how no one was ever going to mistake me for a teenager again, or ask to see my driver's license when I ordered a drink in a bar. I started to be afraid because I grew up after all. Tad's going to preschool, and that means he's going to go to school, then high school."
"Are you saying you took a lover because you felt old?"
He was looking at her, surprised, and she loved him for that, because she supposed that was a part of it. Steve Kemp had found her attractive, and of course that was flattering. That was what had made the flirtation fun in the first place. But it was in no way the greatest part of it. She took his hands and spoke earnestly into his face, thinking, knowing, that she might never speak so earnestly or honestly to any man again. "It's more. It's knowing you can't wait any longer to be a grown-up, or wait any longer to make your peace with what you have. It's knowing that your choices are being narrowed almost daily. For a woman, no, for me, that's a brutal thing to have to face. Wife, that's fine, but you're gone at work. Even when you're home, you're gone at work so much. Mother, that's fine too, but there's a little less of it every year, because every year the world gets another little slice of him. Men, they know what they are. They have an image of what they are. They never live up to the ideal, and it breaks them. And maybe that's why so many men die unhappy and before their time. But they know what being a grown-up is supposed to mean. They have some kind of handle on 30, 40, 50. They don't hear that wind. Or if they do, they find a lance and tilt at it, thinking it must be a windmill or some fucking thing that needs knocking down. And what a woman does, what I did, was to run from becoming. I got scared of the way the house sounded when Tad was gone. Once, do you know, this is crazy. I was in his room, changing the sheets, and I got thinking about these girlfriends I had in high school, wondering what happened to them, where they went. I was almost in a daze. And Tad's closet door swung open, and I screamed and ran out of the room. I don't know why, except I guess I do. I thought for just a second there that Joan Brady would come out of Tad's closet and her head would be gone and there would be blood all over her clothes and she would say, "I died in a car crash when I was 19 coming back from Sammy's Pizza and I don't give a damn."
"Christ, Donna," Vic said.
"I got scared, that's all. I got scared when I'd start looking at knickknacks or thinking about taking a pottery course or yoga or something like that. And the only place to run from the future is into the past. So I started flirting with him."
She looked down and then suddenly buried her face in her hands. Her words were muffled but still understandable.
"It was fun. It was like being in college again. It was like a dream, a stupid dream. It was like he was white noise. He blotted out that wind sound. The flirting part was fun. The sex, it was no good. I had orgasms, but it was no good.
I can't explain why not, except that I still loved you through all of it, and understood that I was running away.
She looked up at him again, crying now.
He's running too. He's made a career of it. He's a poet, at least that's what he calls himself. I couldn't make head or tail of the things he showed me. He's a roadrunner, dreaming he's still in college and protesting the war in Vietnam. That's why it was him, I guess. And now I think you know everything I can tell you. An ugly little tale, but mine own.
I'd like to beat him up, Vic said. If I could make his nose bleed, I guess that would make me feel better.
She smiled wanly. He's gone. Tad and I went for a Dairy Queen after we finished supper and you still weren't home. There's a for rent sign in the window of his shop. I told you he was a roadrunner.
There was no poetry in that note, Vic said.
He looked at her briefly, then down again. She touched his face and he winced back a little. That hurt more than anything else, hurt more than she would have believed. The guilt and fear came again in a glassy, crushing wave, but she wasn't crying anymore. She thought there would be no more tears for a very long time. The wound and the attendant shock trauma were too great. Vic, she said, I'm sorry. You're hurt. And I'm sorry.
When did you break it off?
She told him about the day she had come back and found him there, omitting the fear she'd had that Steve might actually rape her.
Then the note was his way of getting back at you.
She brushed hair away from her forehead and nodded. Her face was pale and wan. There were purplish patches of skin under her eyes. I guess so.
Let's go upstairs, he said. It's late. We're both tired.
Will you make love to me?
He shook his head slowly.
Not tonight.
All right.
They went to the stairs together. At the foot of them, Donna asked,
So, what comes next, Vic?
He shook his head.
I just don't know.
Do I write, I promise never to do it again, 500 times on the blackboard and miss recess? Do we get a divorce? Do we never mention it again? What?
She didn't feel hysterical, only tired, but her voice was rising in a way she didn't like and hadn't intended. The shame was the worst, the shame of being found out and seeing how it had punched his face in. And she hated him as well as herself for making her feel so badly ashamed, because she didn't believe she was responsible for the factors leading up to the final decision, if there really had been a decision.
We ought to be able to get it together, he said.
But she did not mistake him. He wasn't talking to her.
This thing.
He looked at her pleadingly.
He was the only one, wasn't he?
It was the one unforgivable question, the one he had no right to ask. She left him, almost ran up the stairs, before everything could spill out, the stupid recriminations and accusations that would not solve anything but only muddy up whatever poor honesty they had been able to manage. There was little sleep for either of them that night. And the fact that he had forgotten to call Joe Camber and ask him if he could work on his wife's ailing Pinto runabout was the furthest thing from Vic's mind. As for Joe Camber himself, he was sitting with Gary Pervier in one of the decaying lawn chairs which dotted Gary's run-to-riot side yard.
They were drinking vodka martinis out of McDonald's glasses under the stars. Lightning bugs flickered across the dark, and the masses of honeysuckle clinging to Gary's fence filled the hot night with its cloying, heavy scent. Cujo would ordinarily have been chasing after the fireflies, sometimes barking, and tickling both men no end. But tonight he only lay between them with his nose on his paws. They thought he was sleeping, but he wasn't. He simply lay there, feeling the aches that filled his bones and buzzed back and forth in his head. It had gotten hard for him to think what came next in his simple dog's life. Something had gotten in the way of ordinary instinct. When he slept, he had dreams of uncommon, unpleasant vividity. In one of these, he had savaged the boy, had ripped his throat open, and then pulled his guts out of his body in steaming bundles. He had awakened from this dream, twitching and whining. He was continually thirsty, but he had already begun to shy away from his water dish some of the time, and when he did drink, the water tasted like steel shavings. The water made his teeth ache. The water sent bolts of pain through his eyes. And now he lay on the grass, not caring about the lightning bugs or anything else. The voices of the men were unimportant rumbles coming from somewhere above him. They meant little to him compared to his own growing misery.
"Boston," Gary Pervier said and cackled. "Boston? What the hell are you going to do in Boston? And what makes you think I could afford to tag along? I don't think I got enough to go down to the Norge until I get my check cashed." "Fuck you. You're rolling in it," Joe replied. He was getting pretty drunk. "You might have to dig into what's in your mattress a little, that's all." "Nothing in there but bedbugs," Gary said and cackled again. "Place is crawling with them, and I don't give a shit. You ready for another blast?" Joe held out his glass. Gary had the makings right beside his chair. He mixed in the dark with the practiced, steady, and heavy hand of the chronic drinker. "Boston," he said again, handing Joe his drink. He said slyly, "Kicking up your heels, little Joey, I guess." Gary was the only man in Castle Rock, perhaps the world, who could have gotten away with calling him Joey. "Kicking up some whoopee, I guess. Never known you to go further than Portsmouth before."
"I've been to Boston once or twice," Joe said. "You better look out, pervert, or I'll sick my dog on you."
"You couldn't sick that dog on a yelling nigger with a straight razor in each hand," Gary said.
He reached down and ruffled Cujo's fur briefly.
"What's your wife say about it?"
"She don't know we're going. She don't have to know."
"Oh, yeah?"
"She's taken the boy down to Connecticut to see her sister and that freak she's married to. They're gonna be gone a week. She won some money in the lottery. Might as well tell you that right out. They use all the names on the radio anyway. It's all in the prize form she had to sign."
"Won some money in the lottery, did she?"
$5,000.
Gary whistled. Cujo flicked his ears uncomfortably at the sound. Joe told Gary what Charity had told him at supper, leaving out the argument and making it appear a straight trade that had been his idea. The boy could go down to Connecticut for a week with her and up to Moosehead for a week with him in the fall.
"And you're gonna go down to Boston and spend some of that dividend yourself, you dirty dog," Gary said.
He clapped Joe on the shoulder and laughed.
"Oh, you're a one, all right. Why shouldn't I? You know when the last time was I had a day off? I don't. Can't remember. I ain't got much on this week. I'd planned to take most of a day and a half pulling the motor on Richie's International, doing a valve job and all, but with that chain fall, it won't take 4 hours. I'll get him to bring it in tomorrow, and I can do it tomorrow afternoon. I got a transmission job, but that's just a teacher from the grammar school. I can put that back. A few other things the same way. I'll just call him up and tell him I'm having a little holiday. What you gonna do down in Beantown? Well, maybe see the Dead Sox play a couple at Fenway. Go down there to Washington Street. The combat zone, hot damn, I knew it. Gary snorted laughter and slapped his leg. See some of those dirty shows and try to catch the clap. Wouldn't be very much fun alone. Well, I guess I could tag along with you if you was willing to put some of that money my way until I get my check cashed. I'd do that, Joe said.
Gary was a drunkard, but he took a debt seriously.
I ain't been with a woman for about 4 years, I guess, Gary said reminiscently. Lost most of the old sperm factory over there in France. What's left? Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't. Might be fun to find out if I still got any ram left in my ramrod. Yeah, Joe said.
He was slurring now, and his ears were buzzing.
And don't forget the baseball. You know when the last time was I went to Fenway?
No.
1968.
Joe said, leaning forward and tapping out each syllable on Gary's arm for emphasis. He spilled most of his new drink in the process.
Before my kid was born, they played the Tigers and lost 6-4. Those suckers. Norm Cash hit a homer in the top of the eighth. When you thinking of going?
Monday afternoon around 3, I thought. The wife and the boy will want to go out that morning, I guess. I'll take them to the Greyhound station in Portland. That gives me the rest of the morning and half the afternoon to catch up whatever I have to catch up.
You taking the car or the truck?
Car.
Gary's eyes went soft and dreamy in the dark.
Booze, baseball, and broads, he said.
He sat up straighter.
I don't give a shit if I do.
You want to go?
Yeah.
Joe let out a little whoop, and they both got laughing. Neither noticed that Cujo's head had come off his paws at the sound, and that he was growling very softly. Monday morning dawned in shades of pearl and dark gray. The fog was so thick that Brett Camber couldn't see the oak in the side yard from his window, and that oak wasn't but 30 yards away. The house still slept around him, but there was no more sleep left in him. He was going on a trip, and every part of his being vibrated with that news. Just he and his mother. It would be a good trip. He felt that, and deep down inside, beyond any conscious thought, he was glad his father wasn't coming. He would be free to be himself. He would not have to try to live up to some mysterious ideal of masculinity that he knew his father had achieved, but which he himself couldn't yet even begin to comprehend. He felt good, and incredibly alive. He felt sorry for anyone in the world who was not going on a trip this fine foggy morning, which would be another scorcher as soon as the fog burned off. He planned to sit in a window seat of the bus and watch every mile of the journey from the Greyhound terminal on Spring Street all the way to Stratford. It had been a long time before he had been able to get to sleep last night, and here it was, not yet 5 o'clock. But if he stayed in bed any longer, he would explode or something. Moving as quietly as he could, he put on jeans and his Castle Rock Cougars t-shirt, a pair of white athletic socks, and his Keds. He went downstairs and fixed himself a bowl of Cocoa Bears. He tried to eat quietly, but was sure that the crunch of the cereal that he heard in his head must be audible all over the house. Upstairs, he heard his dad grunt and turn over in the double bed he and his mom shared. The springs rasped. Brett's jaws froze. After a moment's debate, he took his second bowl of Cocoa Bears out on the back porch, being careful not to let the screen door slam. The summer smells of everything were greatly clarified in the heavy fog, and the air was already warm. In the east, just above the faint fuzz that marked a belt of pines at the end of the east pasture, he could see the sun. It was as small and silver bright as the full moon when it has risen well up in the sky. Even now, the humidity was a dense thing, heavy and quiet. The fog would be gone by 8 or 9, but the humidity would remain. But for now, what Brett saw was a white secret world, and he was filled with the secret joys of it. The husky smell of hay that would be ready for its first cutting in a week, of manure, of his mother's roses. He could even faintly make out the aroma of Gary Pervier's triumphant honeysuckle, which was slowly burying the fence which marked the edge of his property, burying it in a drift of cloying, grasping vines. He put his cereal bowl aside and walked toward where he knew the barn to be. Halfway across the dooryard, he looked over his shoulder and saw that the house had receded to nothing but a misty outline. A few steps farther, and it was swallowed. He was alone in the white, with only the tiny silver sun looking down on him. He could smell dust, damp, honeysuckle, roses. And then the growling began. His heart leaped into his throat, and he fell back a step, all his muscles tensing into bundles of wire. His first panicky thought, like a child who has suddenly tumbled into a fairy tale, was wolf, and he looked around wildly. There was nothing to see but white. Cujo came out of the fog. Brett began to make a whining noise in his throat. The dog he had grown up with, the dog who had pulled a yelling, gleeful 5-year-old Brett patiently around and around the dooryard on his flexible flyer, buckled into a harness Joe had made in the shop. The dog who had been waiting calmly by the mailbox every afternoon during school for the bus, come shine or shower. That dog bore only the slightest resemblance to the muddy, matted apparition slowly materializing from the morning mist. The St. Bernard's big, sad eyes were now reddish and stupid and lowering, more pig's eyes than dog's eyes. His coat was plated with brownish-green mud, as if he had been rolling around in the boggy place at the bottom of the meadow. His muzzle was wrinkled back in a terrible mock grin that froze Brett with horror. Brett felt his heart slugging away in his throat. Thick white foam dripped slowly from between Cujo's teeth.
"Cujo?" Brett whispered. "Cuj?"
Cujo looked at the boy, not recognizing him anymore, not his looks, not the shadings of his clothes. He could not precisely see colors, at least as human beings understand them. Not his scent. What he saw was a monster on 2 legs. Cujo was sick, and all things appeared monstrous to him now. His head clanged dully with murder. He wanted to bite and rip and tear. Part of him saw a cloudy image of him springing at the boy, bringing him down, parting flesh with bone, drinking blood as it still pulsed, driven by a dying heart. Then the monstrous figure spoke, and Cujo recognized his voice. It was the boy. The boy.
And the boy had never done him any harm. Once he had loved the boy and would have died for him had that been called for.
There was enough of that feeling left to hold the image of murder at bay until it grew as murky as the fog around them. It broke up and rejoined the buzzing, clamorous river of his sickness.
Cujo? What's wrong, boy?
The last of the dog that had been before the bat scratched its nose turned away, and the sick and dangerous dog, subverted for the last time, was forced to turn with it. Cujo stumbled away and moved deeper into the fog. Foam splattered from his muzzle onto the dirt. He broke into a lumbering run, hoping to outrun the sickness, but it ran with him, buzzing and yammering, making him ache with hatred and murder. He began to roll over and over in the high timothy grass, snapping at it, his eyes rolling. The world was a crazy sea of smells. He would track each to its source and dismember it. Cujo began to growl again. He found his feet. He slipped deeper into the fog that was even now beginning to thin. A big dog who weighed just under 200 pounds. Brett stood in the dooryard for more than 15 minutes after Cujo had melted back into the fog, not knowing what to do. Cujo had been sick. He might have eaten a poison bait or something. Brett knew about rabies, and if he had ever seen a woodchuck or a fox or a porcupine exhibiting the same symptoms, he would have guessed rabies. But it never crossed his mind that his dog could have that awful disease of the brain and the nervous system. A poison bait, that seemed the most likely. He should tell his father. His father could call the vet. Or maybe Dad could do something himself. Like that time 2 years ago when he had pulled the porcupine needles out of Cujo's muzzle with his pliers, working each quill first up, then down, then out, being careful not to break them off because they would fester in there. Yes, he would have to tell Dad. Dad would do something, like that time Cujo got into it with Mr. Porcupine. But what about the trip? He didn't need to be told that his mother had won them the trip through some desperate stratagem, or luck, or a combination of the two. Like most children, he could sense the vibrations between his parents, and he knew the way the emotional currents ran from one day to the next, the way a veteran guide knows the twists and turns of an upcountry river. It had been a near thing, and even though his dad had agreed, Brett sensed that this agreement had been grudging and unpleasant. The trip was not on for sure until he had dropped them off and driven away. If he told Dad Cujo was sick, might he not seize on that as an excuse to keep them home? He stood motionless in the dooryard. He was, for the first time in his life, in a total mental and emotional quandary. After a little while, he began to hunt for Cujo behind the barn. He called him in a low voice. His parents were still sleeping, and he knew how sound carried in the morning fog. He didn't find Cujo anywhere, which was just as well for him. The alarm burred Vic awake at 4:45. He got up, shut it off, and blundered down to the bathroom, mentally cursing Roger Breakstone, who could never get to the Portland jetport 20 minutes before check-in like any normal air traveler. Not Roger. Roger was a contingency man. There might always be a flat tire, or a roadblock, or a washout, or an earthquake. Aliens from outer space might decide to touch down on runway 22. He showered, shaved, gobbled vitamins, and went back to the bedroom to dress. The big double bed was empty, and he sighed a little. The weekend he and Donna had just passed hadn't been very pleasant. In fact, he could honestly say he never wanted to go through such a weekend again in his life. They had kept their normal, pleasant faces on for Tad, but Vic had felt like a participant at a masquerade ball. He didn't like to be aware of the muscles in his face at work when he smiled. They had slept in the same bed together, but for the first time, the king-sized double seemed too small to Vic. They slept each on one side, the space between them a crisply sheeted no-man's land. He had lain awake both Friday and Saturday nights, morbidly aware of each shift in Donna's weight as she moved, the sound of her nightdress against her body. He found himself wondering if she was awake, too, on her side of the emptiness that lay between them. Last night, Sunday night, they had tried to do something about that empty space in the middle of the bed. The sex part had been moderately successful, if a little tentative. At least neither of them had cried when it was over. For some reason, he had been morbidly sure that one of them would do that. But Vic was not sure you could call what they had done making love. He dressed in his summer-weight gray suit, as gray as the early light outside, and picked up his two suitcases. One of them was much heavier than the other. That one contained most of the Sharp Serials file. Roger had all the graphic layouts. Donna was making waffles in the kitchen. The teapot was on, just beginning to huff and puff. She was wearing his old blue flannel robe. Her face was puffy, as if instead of resting her, sleep had punched her unconscious. "Will the planes fly when it's like this?" she asked.
"It's going to burn off. You can see the sun already."
He pointed at it, and then kissed her lightly on the nape of the neck.
"You shouldn't have gotten up."
"No problem." She lifted the waffle iron's lid and deftly turned a waffle out on a plate. She handed it to him. "I wish you weren't going away." Her voice was low. "Not now. After last night."
"It wasn't that bad, was it?"
"Not like before," Donna said. A bitter, almost secret smile touched her lips and was gone. She beat the waffle mixture with a wire whisk and then poured a ladleful into the waffle iron and dropped its heavy lid. Sss. She poured boiling water over a couple of red rose bags and took the cups, one said Vic, the other Donna, over to the table. "Eat your waffle. There's strawberry preserves if you want them." He got the preserves and sat down. He spread some oleo across the top of the waffle and watched it melt into the little squares, just as he had when he was a child. The preserves were Schmucker's. He liked Schmucker's preserves. He spread the waffle liberally with them. It looked great, but he wasn't hungry. "Will you get laid in Boston or New York?" she asked, turning her back on him. "Even it out? Tit for tat?" He jumped a little, perhaps even flushed. He was glad her back was turned because he felt that at that precise moment there was more of him on his face than he wanted her to see. Not that he was angry. The thought of giving the bellman a 10 instead of the usual buck and then asking the fellow a few questions had certainly crossed his mind. He knew that Roger had done it on occasion.
"I'm going to be too busy for anything like that."
"What does the ad say? There's always room for Jell-O?"
"Are you trying to make me mad, Donna, or what?"
"No. Go on and eat. You got to feed the machine." She sat down with a waffle of her own, no oleo for her, a dash of Vermont-made syrup, that was all. "How well we know each other," he thought. "What time are you picking Roger up?" she asked him.
"After some hot negotiations, we've settled on 6.
She smiled again, but this time the smile was warm and fond. He really took that early bird business to heart at some point, didn't he?
"Yeah, I'm surprised he hasn't called yet to make sure I'm up.
The phone rang. They looked at each other across the table, and after a silent, considering pause, they both burst out laughing. It was a rare moment, certainly more rare than the careful lovemaking in the dark the night before. He saw how fine her eyes were, how lucent. They were as gray as the morning mist outside.
"Get it quick before it wakes the tatter up," she said.
He did. It was Roger.
He assured Roger that he was up, dressed, and in a fighting frame of mind. He would pick Roger up on the dot of six.
He hung up, wondering if he would end up telling Roger about Donna and Steve Kemp. Probably not. Not because Roger's advice would be bad. It wouldn't be. But even though Roger would promise not to tell Althea, he most certainly would. And he had a suspicion that Althea would find it difficult to resist sharing such a juicy bit of bridge table gossip. Such careful consideration of the question made him feel depressed all over again. It was as if by trying to work out the problem between them, he and Donna were burying their own body by moonlight.
"Good old Roger," he said, sitting down again.
He tried on a smile, but it felt wrong. The moment of spontaneity was gone. "Will you be able to get all of your stuff and all of Roger's into the Jag?"
"Sure," he said. "We'll have to. Althea needs their car, and you've got..." "Oh, shit, I completely forgot to call Joe Camber about your Pinto."
"You had a few other things on your mind," she said. There was faint irony in her voice. "That's all right. I'm not going to send Tad to the playground today. He has the sniffles. I may keep him home the rest of the summer, if that suits you. I get into trouble when he's gone." There were tears choking her voice, squeezing it and blurring it, and he didn't know what to say or how to respond. He watched helplessly as she found a Kleenex, blew her nose, wiped her eyes.
"Whatever," he said, shaken. "Whatever seems best."
He rushed on.
"Just give Camber a call. He's always there, and I don't think it would take him 20 minutes to fix it, even if he has to put in another carb."
"Will you think about it while you're gone?" she asked. "About what we're going to do, the two of us?"
"Yes," he said.
"Good. I will, too. Another waffle?"
"No, thanks."
The whole conversation was turning surreal. Suddenly, he wanted to be out and gone. Suddenly, the trip felt very necessary and very attractive. The idea of getting away from the whole mess, putting miles between him and it. He felt a sudden jab of anticipation. In his mind, he could see the Delta jet cutting through the unraveling fog and into the blue. "Can I have a waffle?" They both looked around, startled. It was Tad standing in the hallway in his yellow footy pajamas, his stuffed coyote grasped by one ear, his red blanket wrapped around his shoulders. He looked like a small, sleepy Indian. "I guess I could rustle one up," Donna said, surprised. Tad was not a notably early riser.
"Was it the phone, Tad?" Vic asked.
Tad shook his head. "I made myself wake up early so I could say goodbye to you, Daddy. Do you really have to go?"
"It's just for a while."
"It's too long," Tad said blackly. "I put a circle around the day you're coming home on my calendar. Mom showed me which one. I'm going to mark off every day, and she said she'd tell me the monster words every night."
"Well, that's okay, isn't it?"
"Will you call?"
"Every other night," Vic said.
"Every night," Tad insisted. He crawled up into Vic's lap and set his coyote next to Vic's plate. Tad began to crunch up a piece of toast. every night, Daddy.
I can't every night, Vic said, thinking of the back-breaking schedule Roger had laid out on Friday before the letter had come.
Why not?
Because.
Because your Uncle Roger is a hard taskmaster, Donna said, putting Tad's waffle on the table. Come on over here and eat. Bring your coyote. Daddy will call us tomorrow night from Boston and tell us everything that happened to him.
Tad took his place at the end of the table. He had a large plastic placemat that said Tad.
Will you bring me a toy?
Maybe, if you're good. And maybe I'll call tonight so you'll know I got to Boston in one piece.
Good deal.
Vic watched, fascinated, as Tad poured a small ocean of syrup over his waffle.
What kind of toy?
We'll see, Vic said.
He watched Tad eat his waffle. It suddenly occurred to him that Tad liked eggs. Scrambled, fried, poached, or hard-boiled, Tad gobbled them up.
Tad?
What, Daddy?
If you wanted people to buy eggs, what would you tell them?
Tad considered.
I'd tell them eggs taste good, he said.
Vic met his wife's eyes again, and they had a second moment like the one that had occurred when the phone rang. This time they laughed telepathically. Their goodbyes were light. Only Tad, with his imperfect grasp of how short the future really was, cried.
You'll think about it?
Donna asked him again as he climbed into the Jag.
Yes.
But driving into Bridgeton to get Roger, what he thought about were those two moments of near-perfect communication. Two in one morning. Not bad. All it took was 8 or 9 years together, roughly a quarter of all the years so far spent on the face of the earth. He got thinking about how ridiculous the whole concept of human communication was. What monstrous, absurd overkill was necessary to achieve even a little. When you'd invested the time and made it good, you had to be careful.
Yes, he'd think about it.
It had been good between them, and although some of the channels were now closed, filled with God knew how much muck, and some of that muck might still be squirming, plenty of the others seemed open and in reasonably good working order. There had to be some careful thought, but perhaps not too much at once. Things had a way of magnifying themselves. He turned the radio up and began to think about the poor old sharp serial professor. Joe Camber pulled up in front of the Greyhound terminal in Portland at 8:10. The fog had burned off and the digital clock atop the Casco Bank and Trust read 73 degrees already. He drove with his hat planted squarely on his head, ready to be angry at anyone who pulled out or cut in front of him. He hated to drive in the city. When he and Gary got to Boston, he intended to park the car and leave it until they were ready to come home. They could take the subways if they could puzzle them out, walk if they couldn't. Charity was dressed in her best pants suit. It was a quiet green, and a white cotton blouse with a ruffle at the neck. She was wearing earrings, and this had filled Brett with a mild sense of amazement. He couldn't remember his mother wearing earrings at all, except to church. Brett had caught her alone when she went upstairs to dress after getting Dad his breakfast oatmeal. Joe had been mostly silent, grunting answers to questions in monosyllables, then shutting off conversation entirely by tuning the radio to WCSH for the ball scores. They were both afraid that the silence might presage a ruinous outburst and a sudden change of mind on their trip. Charity had the slacks of her pants suit on and was slipping into her blouse. Brett noted she was wearing a peach-colored bra, and that had also amazed him. He hadn't known his mother had underclothes in any color other than white. "Ma," he said urgently. She turned to him. It seemed almost that she was turning on him.
Did he say something to you?
No. No. It's Cujo.
Cujo? What about Cujo?
He's sick.
What do you mean, sick?
Brett told her about having his second bowl of cocoa bears out on the back steps, about walking into the fog, and how Cujo had suddenly appeared, his eyes red and wild, his muzzle dripping foam. And he wasn't walking right, Brett finished. He was kind of, you know, staggering. I think I better tell Daddy.
No!
His mother said fiercely and grasped him by the shoulders hard enough to hurt. You do no such thing. He looked at her, surprised and frightened. She relaxed her grip a little and spoke more quietly.
He just scared you, coming out of the fog like that. There's probably nothing wrong with him at all, right?
Brett groped for the right words to make her understand how terrible Cujo had looked, and how for a moment he had thought the dog was going to turn on him. He couldn't find the words. Maybe he didn't want to find them.
If there is something wrong, Charity continued, it's probably just some little thing. He might have gotten a dose of skunk.
I didn't smell any skunk.
Or he might have been running a woodchuck or a rabbit. Might even have jumped a moose down there in that bog. Or he might have eaten some nettles.
I guess he could have, Brett said doubtfully.
Your father would just jump on something like that, she said. I can hear him now. Sick, is he? Well, he's your dog, Brett. You see to him. I got too much work to do to be messing around with your mutt.
Brett nodded unhappily. It was his own thought exactly, magnified by the brooding way his father had been eating breakfast while the sports blared around the kitchen.
If you just leave him, he'll come mooching around your dad, and your dad will take care of him, Charity said. He loves Cujo almost as much as you do, although he'd never say it. If he sees something's wrong, he'll fetch him over to the vets in South Paris.
Yeah, I guess he would.
His mother's words rang true to him, but he was still unhappy about it. She bent and kissed his cheek.
I'll tell you. We can call your father tonight if you want. How would that be? And when you talk to him, you just say, sort of casually, "You feeding my dog, Daddy?" And then you'll know.
Yeah, Brett said. He smiled gratefully at his mother, and she smiled back, relieved, the trouble averted. But, perversely, it had given them something else to worry about during the seemingly interminable period before Joe backed the car up to the porch steps and silently began to load their four pieces of luggage into the wagon. Into one of them, Charity had surreptitiously placed all six of her snapshot albums. This new worry was that Cujo would lurch into the yard before they could drive away and stick Joe Camber with the problem. But Cujo hadn't shown up. Now Joe lowered the tailgate of the country squire, handed Brett the two small bags, and took the two large ones for himself.
Woman, you got so much luggage, I wonder if you ain't leaving on one of those Reno DeVos cruises instead of going down to Connecticut.
Charity and Brett smiled uneasily. It sounded like an attempt at humor, but with Joe Camber, you were never really sure.
That would be a day, she said.
I guess I'd just have to chase you down and drag you back with my new chainfall, he said, unsmiling.
His green hat was cocked squarely on the back of his head.
Boy, you gonna take care of your mom?
Brett nodded.
Yeah, you better.
He measured the boy.
You're getting pretty damn big.
Probably you ain't got a kiss to give your old man.
I guess I do, Daddy, Brett said.
He hugged his father tight and kissed his stubbly cheek, smelling sour sweat and a phantom of last night's vodka. He was surprised and overwhelmed by his love for his father, a feeling that sometimes still came, always when it was least expected, but less and less often over the last 2 or 3 years, something his mother did not know and would not have believed if told. It was a love that had nothing to do with Joe Camber's day-to-day behavior toward him or his mother. It was a brute, biological thing that he would never be free of. A phenomenon with many illusory referents of the sort which haunt for a lifetime. The smell of cigarette smoke, the look of a double-edged razor reflected in a mirror, pants hung over a chair, certain curse words. His father hugged him back and then turned to Charity. He put a finger under her chin and turned her face up a little. From the loading bays behind the squat brick building, they heard a bus warming up. Its engine was a low and guttural diesel rumble.
Have a good time, he said.
Her eyes filled with tears and she wiped them away quickly. The gesture was nearly one of anger.
Okay, she said.
Abruptly, the tight-closed, non-committal expression descended over his face. It came down like the clap of a night's visor. He was the perfect country man again.
Let's get these cases in, boy. Feels like they is lead in this one. Jesus please us.
He stayed with them until all four bags had been checked, looking closely at each tag, oblivious of the baggage handler's condescending expression of amusement. He watched the handler trundle the bags out on a dolly and load them into the guts of the bus. Then he turned to Brett again.
Come on out on the sidewalk with me, he said.
Charity watched them go. She sat down on one of the hard benches, opened her purse, took out a handkerchief, and began fretting at it. It would just be like him to wish her a good time and then try to talk the boy into going back to the home place with him. On the sidewalk, Joe said,
Let me give you 2 pieces of advice, boy. You probably won't take neither of them. Boys seldom do, but I guess that never stopped a father from giving him. First piece of advice is this. That fella you're going to see, that Jim, he's nothing but a piece of shit. One of the reasons I'm letting you go on this jaunt is that you're 10 now, and 10's old enough to tell the difference between a turd and a tea rose. You watch him and you'll see. He don't do nothing but sit in an office and push papers. People like him is half the trouble with this world, because their brains have got unplugged from their hands.
Thin, hectic color had risen in Joe's cheeks.
He's a piece of shit. You watch him and see if you don't agree.
All right, Brett said. His voice was low but composed.
Joe Camber smiled a little.
The second piece of advice is to keep your hand on your pocketbook.
I haven't got any
Camber held out a rumpled $5 bill.
Yeah, you got this. Don't spend it all in one place. The fool and his money soon parted.
All right, thank you.
So long,
Camber said. He didn't ask for another kiss. Goodbye, Daddy. Brett stood on the sidewalk and watched his father climb into the car and drive away. He never saw his father alive again. At 8:15 that morning, Gary Pervier staggered out of his house in his pea-stained underwear shorts and urinated into the honeysuckle. In a perverse sort of way, he hoped that someday his piss would become so rancid with booze that it would blight the honeysuckle. That day hadn't come yet.
"Ah, my head," he screamed, holding it with his free hand as he watered the honeysuckle which had buried his fence.
His eyes were threaded with bright snaps of scarlet. His heart clattered and roared like an old water pump that was drawing more air than water just lately. A terrible stomach cramp seized him as he finished voiding himself. They had been getting more common lately, and as he doubled up, a large and foul-smelling flatulence purred out from between his skinny shanks. He turned to go back in, and that was when he heard the growling begin. It was a low, powerful sound coming from just beyond the point where his overgrown side yard merged with the hayfield beyond it. He turned toward the sound quickly, his headache forgotten, the clatter and roar of his heart forgotten, the cramp forgotten. It had been a long time since he'd had a flashback to his war in France, but he had one now. Suddenly, his mind was screaming, "Germans! Germans! Squad down!" But it wasn't the Germans. When the grass parted, it was Cujo who appeared.
"Hey, boy, what are you growling for?" Gary said, and then faltered.
It had been 20 years since he had seen a rabid dog, but you don't forget the look. He had been in an Amoco station east of Machias, headed back from a camping trip down Eastport way. He had been driving the old Indian motorcycle he'd had for a while in the mid-50s. A panting, slat-sided yellow dog had drifted by outside that Amoco station like a ghost. Its sides had been moving in and out in rapid, shallow sprints of respiration. Foam was dripping from its mouth in a steady, watery stream. Its eyes were rolling wildly. Its hindquarters were caked with shit. It had been reeling rather than walking, as if some unkind soul had opened its jaws an hour before and filled it full of cheap whiskey.
"Hot damn, there he is," the pump jockey said.
He had dropped the adjustable wrench he was holding and had rushed into the cluttered, dingy little office which adjoined the station's garage bay. He had come out with a 30-30 clutched in his greasy, big-knuckled hands. He went out onto the tarmac, dropped to one knee, and started shooting. His first shot had been low, shearing away one of the dog's back legs in a cloud of blood. That yellow dog never even moved, Gary remembered as he stared at Cujo now. Just looked around blankly, as if it didn't have the slightest idea what was happening to it. The pump jockey's second try had cut the dog almost in half. Cuts hit the station's one pump in a black and red splash. A moment later, three more guys had pulled in, three of Washington County's finest, crammed shoulder to shoulders in the cab of a 1940 Dodge pickup. They were all armed. They piled out and pumped another 8 or 9 rounds into the dead dog. An hour after that, as the pump jockey was finishing up putting a new headlamp on the front of Gary's Indian cycle, the county dog officer arrived in a Studebaker with no door on the passenger side. She donned long rubber gloves and cut off what was left of the yellow dog's head to send to State Health and Welfare. Cujo looked a hell of a lot spryer than that long-ago yellow dog, but the other symptoms were exactly the same.
"Not too far gone," he thought. "More dangerous. Holy Jesus! Got to get my gun."
He started to back away.
"Hi, Cujo. Nice dog. Nice boy. Nice doggy."
Cujo stood at the edge of the lawn, his great head lowered, his eyes reddish and filmy, growling.
"Nice boy."
To Cujo, the words coming from the man meant nothing. They were meaningless sounds, like the wind.
What mattered was the smell coming from the man. It was hot, rank, and pungent. It was the smell of fear. It was maddening and unbearable. He suddenly understood the man had made him sick. He lunged forward, the growl in his chest mounting into a heavy roar of rage. Gary saw the dog coming for him. He turned and ran. One bite, one scratch could mean death. He ran for the porch in the safety of the house beyond the porch. But there had been too many drinks, too many long winter days by the stove, and too many long summer nights in the lawn chair. He could hear Cujo closing in behind him. And then there was the terrible split second when he could hear nothing and understood that Cujo had leaped. As he reached the first splintery step of his porch, 200 pounds of St. Bernard hit him like a locomotive, knocking him flat and driving the wind from him. The dog went for the back of his neck. Gary tried to scramble up. The dog was over him, the thick fur of its underbelly nearly suffocating him, and it knocked him back down easily. Gary screamed. Cujo bit him high on the shoulder, his powerful jaws closing and crunching through the bare skin, pulling tendons like wires. He continued to growl. Blood flew. Gary felt it running warmly down his skinny upper arm. He turned over and battered at the dog with his fists. It gave back a little, and Gary was able to scramble up 3 more steps on his feet and hands. Then Cujo came again. Gary kicked at the dog. Cujo fainted the other way and then came boring in, snapping and growling. Foam flew from his jaws, and Gary could smell his breath. It smelled rotten, rank, and yellow. Gary balled his right fist and swung in a roundhouse, connecting with the bony shelf of Cujo's lower jaw. It was mostly luck. The jolt of the impact ran all the way up to his shoulder, which was on fire from the deep bite. Cujo backed off again. Gary looked at the dog, his thin, hairless chest moving rapidly up and down. His face was ashy gray. The laceration on his shoulder welled blood that splattered on the peeling porch steps.
"Come for me, you son of a whore," he said. "Come on, come on. I don't give a shit."
He screamed, "You hear me? I don't give a shit." But Cujo backed off another pace. The words still had no meaning, but the smell of fear had left the man. Cujo was no longer sure if he wanted to attack or not. He hurt. He hurt so miserably, and the world was such a crazy quilt of sense and impression. Gary got shakily to his feet. He backed up the last 2 steps of the porch. He backed across the porch's width and felt behind him for the handle of the screen door. His shoulder felt as if raw gasoline had been poured under the skin. His mind raved at him.
"Rabies! I got the rabies!"
Never mind. One thing at a time. His shotgun was in the hall closet. Thank Christ Charity and Brett Camber were gone from up on the hill. That was God's mercy at work. He found the screen door's handle and pulled the door open. He kept his eyes locked on Cujo's until he had backed in and pulled the screen door shut behind him. Then a great relief swept through him. His legs went rubbery. For a moment, the world swam away, and he pulled himself back by sticking his tongue out and biting down on it. This was no time to swoon like a girl. He could do that after the dog was dead, if he wanted. Christ, but it had been close out there. He had thought he was going to punch out for sure. He turned and headed down the darkened hallway to the closet. And that was when Cujo smashed through the lower half of the screen door, muzzle wrinkled back from his teeth in a kind of sneer, a dry volley of barking sounds coming from his chest.
Gary screamed again and whirled just in time to catch Cujo in both arms as the dog leaped again, driving him back down the hall, bouncing from side to side and trying to keep his feet. For a moment, they almost seemed to waltz. Then Gary, who was 50 pounds lighter, went down. He was dimly aware of Cujo's muzzle burrowing in under his chin, was dimly aware that Cujo's nose was almost sickeningly hot and dry. He tried getting his hands up and was thinking that he would have to go for Cujo's eyes with his thumbs when Cujo seized his throat and tore it open. Gary screamed and the dog savaged him again. Gary felt warm blood sheet across his face and thought, "Dear God, that's mine." His hands beat weakly and ineffectually at Cujo's upper body, doing no damage. At last, they fell away. Faintly, sick and cloying, he smelled honeysuckle. "What do you see out there?" Brett turned a little toward the sound of his mother's voice. Not all the way. He did not want to lose sight of the steadily unrolling view, even for a little while. The bus had been on the road for almost an hour. They had crossed the $1 million bridge into South Portland. Brett had stared with fascinated, wondering eyes at the two scum-caked rust-bucket freighters in the harbor, joined the turnpike going south, and were now approaching the New Hampshire border. "Everything," Brett said. "What do you see, Mom?" She thought, "Your reflection in the glass, very faint. That's what I see." Instead, she answered, "Why, the world, I guess. I see the world unrolling in front of us. Mom, I wish we could ride all the way to California on this bus, see everything there is in the geography books at school." She laughed and ruffled his hair. "You'd get damn tired of scenery, Brett."
"No. No, I wouldn't."
And he probably wouldn't, she thought. Suddenly, she felt both sad and old. When she had called Holly Saturday morning to ask her if they could come, Holly had been delighted, and her delight had made Charity feel young. It was strange that her own son's delight, his almost palpable euphoria, would make her feel old. Nevertheless, what exactly is there going to be for him, she asked herself, studying his ghost-like face, which was superimposed over the moving scenery like a camera trick. He was bright, brighter than she was, and much brighter than Joe. He ought to go to college, but she knew that when he got to high school, Joe would press him to sign up for the shop and automotive maintenance courses so he could be more help around the place. 10 years ago, he wouldn't have been able to get away with it. The guidance counselors wouldn't have allowed a bright boy like Brett to opt for all manual trade courses. But in these days of phase electives and do your own thing, she was terribly afraid it might happen. It made her afraid. Once she had been able to tell herself that school was far away, so very far away. High school, real school. Grammar school was nothing but play to a boy who slipped through his lessons as easily as Brett did. But in high school, the business of irrevocable choices began. Doors slipped shut with a faint locking click that was only heard clearly in the dreams of later years. She gripped her elbows and shivered, not even kidding herself that it was because the hound's air conditioning was turned up too high. For Brett, high school was now just 4 years away. She shivered again and suddenly found herself wishing viciously that she had never won the money or that she had lost the ticket. They had only been away from Joe for an hour, but it was the first time she had really been separated from him since they had married in late 1966. She hadn't realized that perspective would be so sudden, so dizzying, and so bitter. Picture this. Woman and boy are let free from brooding Castle Keep, but
There's a catch. Stapled to their backs are large hooks, and slipped over the ends of the hooks are heavy-duty invisible rubber bands. And before you can get too far, presto wizzo, you're snapped back inside for another 14 years. She made a little croaking sound in her throat.
Did you say something, Mom?
No, just clearing my throat. She shivered a third time, and this time her arms broke out in goose flesh. She had recalled a line of poetry from one of her own high school English classes. She had wanted to take the college courses, but her father had been furious at the idea. Did she think they were rich? And her mother had laughed the idea to death, gently and pityingly. It was from a poem by Dylan Thomas, and she couldn't remember the whole thing, but it had been something about moving through dooms of love. That line had seemed funny and perplexing to her then, but she thought she understood it now. What else did you call that heavy-duty invisible rubber band, if not love? Was she going to kid herself and say that she did not, even now, in some way, love the man she had married? That she stayed with him only out of duty or for the sake of the child? That was a bitter laugh. If she ever left him, it would be for the sake of the child. That he had never pleasured her in bed. That he could not, sometimes at the most unexpected moments, like the one back at the bus station, be tender. And yet. Brett was looking out the window and rapped. Without turning from the view, he said, "You think Cujo's all right, Mom?"
"I'm sure he's fine," she said absently.
For the first time, she found herself thinking about divorce in a concrete way. What she could do to support herself and her son, how they would get along in such an unthinkable, almost unthinkable situation. If she and Brett didn't come home from this trip, would he come after them, as he had vaguely threatened back in Portland? Would he decide to let Charity go to the bad, but try to get Brett back by fair means, or foul? She began to tick the various possibilities over in her mind, weighing them, suddenly thinking that maybe a little perspective wasn't such a bad thing after all. Painful, maybe. Maybe useful, too. The Greyhound slipped across the state line into New Hampshire and rolled on south. The Delta 727 rose steeply, button-hooked over Castle Rock. Vic always looked for his house near Castle Lake in 117, always fruitlessly, and then headed back toward the coast. It was a 20-minute run to Logan Airport. Donna was down there, some 18,000 feet below, and the Tatter. He felt a sudden depression mixed with a black premonition that it wasn't going to work, that they were crazy to even think it might. When your house blew down, you had to build a new house. You couldn't put the old one back together again with Elmer's glue. The stewardess came by. He and Roger were riding in first class. "Might as well enjoy it while we can, buddy," Roger had said last Wednesday when he made the reservations. "Not everyone can go to the poor farm in such impeccable style." And there were only 4 or 5 other passengers, most of them reading the morning paper, as was Roger.
"Can I get you anything?"
she asked Roger with that professional twinkly smile that seemed to say she had been overjoyed to get up this morning at 5:30 to make the upsy-downsy run from Bangor to Portland to Boston to New York to Atlanta. Roger shook his head absently, and she turned that unearthly smile on Vic.
"Anything for you, sir? Sweet roll? Orange juice?"
"Could you rustle up a screwdriver?"
Vic asked, and Roger's head came out of his paper with a snap. The stew's smile didn't falter. A request for a drink before 9 in the morning was no news to her.
"I can rustle one up," she said. "But you'll have to hustle to get it all down. It's really only a hop to Boston."
"I'll hustle,"
Vic promised solemnly, and she passed on her way back up to the galley, resplendent in her powder blue slacks uniform and her smile.
"What's with you?" Roger asked.
"What do you mean, what's with me?"
"You know what I mean. I never even saw you drink a beer before noon before. Usually not before 5.
"I'm launching the boat," Vic said.
"What boat?"
"The RMS Titanic," Vic said.
Roger frowned.
"That's sort of poor taste, don't you think?"
He did, as a matter of fact. Roger deserved something better. But this morning, with the depression still on him like a foul-smelling blanket, he just couldn't think of anything better. He managed a rather bleak smile instead, but Roger went on frowning at him.
"Look," Vic said, "I've got an idea on this Zingers thing. It's going to be a bitch convincing old man Sharp and the kid, but it might work."
Roger looked relieved. It was the way it had always worked with them. Vic was the raw idea man, Roger the shaper and implementer. They had always worked as a team when it came to translating the ideas into media and in the matter of presentation. "What is it?"
"Give me a little while," Vic said. "Until tonight, maybe. Then we'll run it up the flagpole."
"And see who drops their pants?"
Roger finished with a grin. He shook his paper open to the financial page again.
"Okay, as long as I get it by tonight. Sharp stock went up another 1/8 last week. Were you aware of that?"
"Dandy," Vic murmured and looked out the window again.
No fog now, the day was as clear as a bell. The beaches at Kennebunk and Ogunquit and York formed a panoramic picture postcard, cobalt blue sea, khaki sand, and then the main landscape of low hills, open fields, and thick bands of fir stretching west and out of sight. Beautiful. And it made his depression even worse.
"If I have to cry, I'm damn well going into the crapper to do it," he thought grimly.
6 sentences on a sheet of cheap paper had done this to him. It was a goddamn fragile world, as fragile as one of those Easter eggs that were all pretty colors on the outside, but hollow on the inside. Only last week he had been thinking of just taking Tad and moving out. Now he wondered if Tad and Donna would still be there when he and Roger got back. Was it possible that Donna might just take the kid and decamp, maybe to her mother's place in the Poconos? Sure, it was possible. She might decide that 10 days apart wasn't enough, not for him, not for her. Maybe a 6-month separation would be better. And she had Tad now. Possession was 9 points of the law, wasn't it? And maybe... A crawling, insinuating voice inside spoke up. Maybe she knows where camp is. Maybe she'll decide to go to him, try it with him for a while. They can search for their happy pasts together. Now there's a nice, crazy Monday morning thought, he told himself uneasily. But the thought wouldn't go away. Almost, but not quite. He managed to finish every drop of his screwdriver before the plane touched down at Logan. It gave him acid indigestion that he knew would last all morning long, like the thought of Donna and Steve Kemp together. It would come creeping back even if he gobbled a whole roll of Tums. But the depression lifted a little, and so maybe it was worth it. Maybe. Joe Camber looked at the patch of garage floor below his big vice clamp with something like wonder. He pushed his green felt hat back on his forehead, stared at what was there a while longer, then put his fingers between his teeth and whistled piercingly.
"Cool Joe! Hey, boy! Come, Cool Joe!"
He whistled again and then leaned over, hands on his knees. The dog would come, he had no doubt of that. Cujo never went far. But how was he going to handle this? The dog had shat on the garage floor. He had never known Cujo to do such a thing, not even as a pup. He had piddled around a few times, as puppies will, and he had torn the bejesus out of a chair cushion or two, but there had never been anything like this. He wondered briefly if maybe some other dog had done it, and then dismissed the thought. Cujo was the biggest dog in Castle Rock, so far as he knew. Big dogs ate big, and big dogs crapped big. No poodle or beagle or Heinz 57 varieties had done this mess. Joe wondered if the dog could have sensed that Charity and Brett were going away for a spell. If so, maybe this was his way of showing just how that idea set with him. Joe had heard of such things. He had taken the dog in payment for a job he had done in 1975. The customer had been a one-eyed fellow named Ray Crowell from up Freiburg way. This Crowell spent most of his time working in the woods, although it was acknowledged that he had a fine touch with dogs. He was good at breeding them and good at training them. He could have made a decent living doing what New England country people sometimes called dog farming. But his temper was not good, and he drove many customers away with his sullenness.
"I need a new engine in my truck," Crowell had told Joe that spring.
"Yeah," Joe had said.
"I got the motor, but I can't pay you nothing. I'm tapped out."
They had been standing just inside Joe's garage, chewing on stems of grass. Brett, then five, had been goofing around in the dooryard while Charity hung out clothes.
"Well, that's too bad, Ray," Joe said. "But I don't work for free. This ain't no charitable organization."
"Mrs. Beasley just had herself a litter," Ray said.
Mrs. Beasley was a prime bitch St. Bernard.
"Purebreds. You do the work and I'll give you the pick of the litter. What do you say? You'd be coming out ahead, but I can't cut no pulp if I don't have a truck to haul it in." "Don't need a dog," Joe said. "Especially a big one like that. Goddamn St. Bernards ain't nothing but eating machines."
"You don't need a dog," Ray said, casting an eye out at Brett, who was now just sitting on the grass and watching his mother. "But your boy might appreciate one."
Joe opened his mouth and then closed it again. He and Charity didn't use any protection, but there had been no more kids since Brett, and Brett himself had been a long while coming. Sometimes, looking at him, a vague question would form itself in Joe's head. Was the boy lonely? Perhaps he was. And perhaps Ray Crowell was right. Brett's birthday was coming up. He could give him the pup then.
"I'll think about it," he said.
"Well, don't think too long," Ray said, bridling. "I can go see Vin Callahan over in North Conway. He's just as handy as you are, Camber. Handier, maybe."
"Maybe," Joe said, unperturbed.
Ray Crowell's temper did not scare him in the least. Later that week, the manager of the Shop and Save drove his Thunderbird up to Joe's to get the transmission looked at. It was a minor problem, but the manager, whose name was Donovan, fussed around the car like a worried mother while Joe drained the transmission fluid well, refilled it, and tightened the bands. The car was a piece of work, all right, a 1960 T-Bird in cherry condition. And as he finished the job, listening to Donovan talk about how his wife wanted him to sell the car, Joe had had an idea.
"I'm thinking about getting my boy a dog," he told this Donovan as he let the T-Bird down off the jacks.
"Oh, yes?"
Donovan asked politely.
"Yeah, St. Bernard. It's just a pup now, but it's gonna eat big when it grows. Now, I was just thinking that we might make a little deal, you and me. If you was to guarantee me a discount on that dry dog food, Gaines Meal, Ralston Purina, whatever you sell, I'd guarantee you to work on your bird here every once in a while. No labor charges.
Donovan had been delighted, and the two of them had shaken on it. Joe had called Ray Crowell and said he'd decided to take the pup if Crowell was still agreeable. Crowell was, and when his son's birthday rolled around that year, Joe had astounded both Brett and Charity by putting the squirming, wriggling puppy into the boy's arms.
"Thank you, Daddy! Thank you! Thank you!"
Brett had cried, hugging his father and covering his cheeks with kisses.
"Sure," Joe said. "But you take care of him, Brett. He's your dog, not mine. I guess if he does any piddling or crapping around, I'll take him out in back of the barn and shoot him for a stranger."
"I will, Daddy. I promise."
He had kept his promise, pretty much, and on the few occasions he forgot, either Charity or Joe himself had cleaned up after the dog with no comment. And Joe had discovered it was impossible to stand aloof from Cujo. As he grew, and he grew damned fast, developing into exactly the sort of eating machine Joe had foreseen, he simply took his place in the Camber family. He was one of your bona fide good dogs. He had house-trained quickly and completely. And now this. Joe turned around, hands stuffed in his pockets, frowning. No sign of Cooge anywhere. He stepped outside and whistled again.
Damn dog was maybe down in the creek cooling off. Joe wouldn't blame him. It felt like 85 in the shade already.
But the dog would come back soon, and when he did, Joe would rub his nose in that mess. He would be sorry to do it if Cooge had made it because he was missing his people, but you couldn't let a dog get away with...
A new thought came. Joe slapped the flat of his hand against his forehead. Who was going to feed Cujo while he and Gary were gone? He supposed he could fill up that old pig trough behind the barn with Gaines' meal. They had just about a long ton of the stuff stored downstairs in the cellar, but it would get soggy if it rained. And if he left it in the house or the barn, Cujo might just decide to up and crap on the floor again. Also, when it came to food, Cujo was a big, cheerful glutton. He would eat half the first day, half the second day, and then walk around hungry until Joe came back.
"Shit," he muttered.